Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to the latest Ramble Meets. I'm Andy Brassel, and this one was a great pleasure for me because it was the German author and journalist Uli Hesse, who I sat down with at the end of a long and very enjoyable football weekend in northern Germany, for which he was our guide. Uli, having written a ton of books, most notably Tor, on the history of German football. He's written books on Bayern, Borussia Dortmund, his club as well. Now works at Elf Freunde, the excellent German football magazine. He took us around and showed us what was what from Dusseldorf to Bochum. And he very kindly made some time for us at the end of weekend. We didn't really have anywhere to do it, so we just sat down in a quietish corner of a restaurant, which, despite it being Sunday night and selling Austrian schnitzel, was playing loads of banging music, as I'm sure you'll be aware of. And it was a good point to start our chat, because even though this particular music is not Uli's bag, Uli actually started out as a music journalist and has got loads of rich musical stories to tell us. So that was the starting point to our conversation, which went off in several different directions, which I'm sure you're really going to love after that. So this is Ramble Meets with Uli Hesse. Enjoy.
We started this weekend talking about the great musical traditions of Düsseldorf, where we currently are, and talking about Kraftwerk. They can be considered responsible for this, I suppose.
You mean for this, for our journey to Düsseldorf, or
for music everywhere?
Yeah, in a way, well, for a certain strand of music, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I grew up, with guitar bands and punk bands and everything. So, but yeah, Kraftwerk. I mean, funnily enough, I really didn't really appreciate it when they were around.
Did you not?
No, not really. I was too young, I think.
Right.
I was, I was born in 66, so by the time I really got around to going to gigs and writing about music, it was, like I said, I was more into guitar bands. Although, of course, I grew up on John Peel.
Really?
I'm from Dortmund.
Yeah.
And the British Army on the Rhine, was in the western part of Germany. So that's why we had BFBS, the British Forces Broadcasting Service.
Okay.
So we would get John Peel. It's sometimes funny when I met people from, for instance, from Bavaria, who've had AFN, the American station. And then I realized they never heard John Peel, or, they just couldn't listen to it. That sounds amazing, but I'm always surprised when people say that. When we moved to the Baltic Sea, I checked out a record store in Lübeck, and then I bought a record quite cheaply for, I think it was 4 euros, an Inca Babies album. And the guy at the counter said, "Oh, I'm surprised anybody knows this band." And I said, "Well, yeah, John Peel used to play them all the time." And then he said, "Well, I never heard John Peel, because he was from the north. I forgot, the Americans as well, I think. So he probably had American radio."
So were you a music writer before you were a football writer?
Yeah, that was the idea. Yeah, the whole idea was to be... Well, actually, the idea was... for instance, a lot of people always ask me why I can write books in English. People sometimes assume that, the books that I publish in England, like Tor or Building the Yellow Wall, are translation of German books, but they're not. They're
written directly into English.
Yeah, and specifically for... I always think that somebody who picks up the book and reads it should realize that it's not a German book, Because, for instance, in Tor, I spend a lot of time explaining what German club names mean, or
yes,
things you would never have to do in Germany, obviously. Yeah. And there's lots of people out there who's lots of non-native speakers of English, who speak English a lot better than I am, than I do. But they always say, "But I couldn't write that. I couldn't write in a foreign language."
Yeah.
And that really has to do with the fact that a friend of mine who's a bit older than I am, he was a teacher of English, and he put out a fanzine, and the fanzine was in English.
Okay.
And the idea was just your audience is just so much bigger. I don't know how many magazines we sold to Japan, There's some crazy record collectors out there in Japan. They would just send us blank checks, and saying, "Send me these records." And we would have to explain to them, "We're only reviewing them, We don't have them." Anyway, so from age 15 or 16 or whatever, I had to do record reviews and articles about bands in English. And it was just... I suppose it's just, training.
So was the start of writing about sports when you did your thesis on baseball, didn't you?
Yeah. The idea was... actually, there was no idea. I went to university because I had no idea what to do with my life,
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, so I thought, university is a way to ward off a responsible adult life for as long as possible. Then I did quite well at university. I liked it, and when I did my master's thesis, I went to quite a famous American professor, David Galloway, and I asked him what I should do for a master's thesis, And basically, the gist of it is he said, do something you're interested in and don't bother me with, you know, like 1500 master theses on Hemingway or whatever, you know? Find something nobody's done before. So I, a couple of weeks later, I came back and said, how about baseball? And he said, well, that's fantastic. Do that. So I did that. So for a while, I thought, yeah, maybe I would even stay at university, you know?
And become an academic.
Yeah.
Do you think you've done that in a sort of football-y way?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, Andy, the idea was I go to university, I do silly nerdy stuff nobody's really interested in, and my wife, who's an architect, earns the money.
All right.
Perfect plan, right? Perfect life. So that was the idea. Then suddenly she came up to me and said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I need a break. Mm. You know, she was really overworked. And so at that point, I thought, okay, just supposed that I have to earn money. How would I actually do that? and so what I did was I'd just done a piece for the fanzine with a guy called Wayne Kramer from the MC5.
Yes, yeah.
And it was really amazing because his life story is fantastic. Mm. You know, it's this revolutionary band, and then the band breaks up, which is his life, and he doesn't know what to do, so he sells drugs, and he gets busted, and he goes to prison. And fantastic life. so I thought, I think I could, you know, I could rewrite that in German and in a non-fanzine-y style,
yes,
and sell that to a proper music magazine. So I did that, and then I put it in an envelope and sent it off to Rolling Stone magazine in Germany. They were just starting that back then in the mid-90s, so the German Rolling Stone. And I didn't hear anything from them for weeks, so I phoned them up. So, of course, I now know that you're not supposed to do that. I mean, that's not how it works.
The naivety of youth.
I phoned them up and said, hey, I sent you guys an article, and you didn't reply. What happened? And they said, oh, we forgot to tell you. It's going to be in the next issue. And could you invoice us for 850 marks? And I never had that much money before. So I thought, okay, interesting. So then I started writing for Rolling Stone. So I wrote for Rolling Stone Germany for a while.
Yeah.
But eventually we ran out of subjects, you know, because I like Neil Young, but yes, I'm not that much into Neil Young, you know, and the kind of, you know, punky or post-punk bands that I like were not really Rolling Stone material.
Sure.
But they have this, Rolling Stone has this general interest section. You know, they will always pick up on what's happening in society and cover other things apart from music, pop cultural things. And that was in the early 90s, early to mid-90s when the football boom started.
Yeah.
You know, the Premier League came about, the Champions League.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in the 80s when we went to games, people would say we're crazy, you know, because only hooligans or... people would look at you in a strange way if you said you're a football fan.
It's a funny thing how that, as you say, pan-European sort of football becoming fashionable is like a relatively new thing. I remember like when I started going to football in the mid to late 80s, if you said that you went to football, people looked at you as if you were scum. You know, and it was the same in England, absolutely.
Yeah, and it was not fashionable. I mean, I later did a book about an oral history book about Borussia Dortmund fans, which was great fun because we also asked people for photos, you know, saying, did you take photos at the games? Could you give them? And we received a guy went to a game at the Olympic Stadium in Munich between Bayern and Dortmund in the 80s. And it was a regular Bundesliga game, and you look at the pictures. And you think, is this a post-apocalyptic scene? You know, is this like The Walking Dead or what? I mean, has this ground been attacked or whatever? Because it's really almost empty, you know? There were games, you know, top-level Bundesliga games between Bayern and Dortmund with 9 or 10,000 people at the Olympic Stadium, which was a vast ground. And suddenly this changed, you know? Not exactly overnight, but it changed fairly quickly. And so I went out and I talked to a lot of people and did interviews. And, you know, I went to cinema festivals where they were suddenly showing football films. and there would be discussions about it, you know, as if it were an intellectual or viable subject, you know. Very funny, very interesting. So I did a long piece about that, and I met quite a few people during the research for that, and that's how I got into football writing. Slowly, gradually, but eventually I ended up writing about nothing else but football, which is funny, but that's what happened.
So at the beginning, when you started going to see Borussia Dortmund, and I, from what I gather, it was a bit of a family rite of passage, did you have any pretensions, any childhood dreams to be involved in the game, whether it be playing or working in the game or anything like that? Or was it just that your first idea of having a career in the game was when you kind of stumbled into it almost?
Yeah. I mean, I often say there's this cliche about sports writers that they're failed athletes.
Yes.
Which is not the case with me. So
me neither.
Yeah.
I am a failed athlete, but I didn't try.
I mean, there's a fantastic series of book called The Best American Sports Writing.
Yeah.
Edited by Glenn Stoud, and in one of his, he always writes an introduction to those collections, and in one of those, he said that if you want to be a really good sports writer, you should not be interested. You know, your primarily interest should not be the sports, but the writing. So you've got to love writing.
Yes.
And then choose a subject you know well to write about. Yeah. And that absolutely holds true for me. That's how I became a sports writer. Although there was a point, and I once wrote a column for ESPN about that. Of course, like any young boy, I played football and I played on the team and I dreamed of becoming a professional footballer. But I didn't know how you do that, you know, when you're 10 or 11 years, how do you actually become a professional footballer? So I thought, well, I just ask the one man who should know, which was the coach of my favorite team. So I wrote a letter to Otto Rehhagel.
Is that right?
And he never replied. I mean, this was 76 or 77, and he was the Dortmund coach at the time. And he never replied. And I was, you know, I never forgave him for a very, very long time.
You see, if it had been Klopp era Dortmund, he would have replied.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true.
So, I mean, Dortmund are such a team that's captured the imagination in the world. I mean, and when you know you wrote "Building the Yellow Wall," it wasn't so much about Borussia Dortmund and your relationship even with Borussia Dortmund, but it was about Borussia Dortmund, as you say, as the biggest cult club in the world. I mean, when you look back at your early days of going to see Dortmund when you in the 1970s. Is it still the club recognisable from then? How much has changed? And you know, do you think that you know it's a sort of accident of nature, a happy accident of nature that you were born in Dortmund, that it was your club, and that you had source material to an extent?
Yeah, it was. You know, one of the great things about being a writer is that you're given a chance to reinvent yourself. You know.
Yeah.
Romanticize a bit. So every book I've ever done mentions that I was born in Dortmund and born just a couple of miles away from the ground, which is all true.
Yeah.
But when I was 1 year old, my family moved away from Dortmund, just 20 minutes down the road. But that's, when you're young, that's quite a distance.
For sure.
So it's probably the main reason I became a Dortmund fan. It's not so much that I was born there or that we live close nearby, because...
Well, to reaffirm that attachment to where you were born.
Because Dortmund, you know, the Ruhr area is very... There's tons of clubs in the Ruhr area.
Yeah.
So when I grew up in our street, there were all kinds... You know, people supported all kinds of clubs. Lots of people supported Borussia Mönchengladbach in the 70s.
Of course.
Because they were the cool club, you know. Yeah. But Dortmund was really because of my brother. Mm. He's 12 years older than I am, and he started going in the 60s. And he was one of the... when I did this book, which I just mentioned, which is sort of a oral history of the club,
yes,
it was also a bit of my way of saying thank you to him. And if you read the book, you won't because it's a German book, but I dedicated to him, and he's interviewed in the book. Mm-hmm. But since we didn't have the same father, nobody who reads the book will know that it is my brother. So I did this on purpose just because, and because he was my big hero, and I thought of, and he was one of the very, you know, Dortmund were a big club in the 50s and 60s. Then when I was young, they weren't a big club. They were in the second division, you know. And he was one of the few people who followed the club when they were in the second division. And it was, so the guy is older than I am. He's my brother. He's your hero anyway, if he's your older brother. Then my mum would always say mysterious things like, I would say, where's Klaus, my brother? And she would say, oh, he's off to Mülheim or Erkenschwick with Borussia. And it always sounded a bit like the guy's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But it sounded totally mysterious to me and fantastic, you know? I thought, God, he's going to Erkenschwick with Borussia, fantastic. I want to do that when I'm grown up, you know? So that's more or less why it's Dortmund for me. It's this family thing, which is still there. So that's still there. So I just recently did a piece about that for the magazine I'm writing now for, because we...
El Freunde.
Everything's become so commercialized, and so many people my age are actually turning away from the game. So we did a cover story on why we still love football. You know, what's still, and the angle that I picked is that, it's not just the game as played between the lines. You know, it's the people in the stands and the people you meet, and I still meet my brother whenever I see Dortmund play. Like at one point we started families, and we would only see each other on my mum's birthday and Christmas and whenever Dortmund were playing at home. And it's like this to this day. I know where my brother's standing, he's still on the terrace. So that's one thing why the club is still the same. Another, and I don't know if you've, for people who've never been to Dortmund, it's not the nicest city in the world, but everything that has to do with football is really cool, because you can go from the city centre to the ground in like 30 minutes. You can just walk over there. And the old ground is right next to the new ground. And the old ground now still looks almost exactly like it did in the 60s when my brother saw his first game there. And the lower part of the new ground is still exactly the same as it was when I saw my first game in 77. So when I go onto the terrace, you know, I still walk up the same steps, the rails are the same, the crush barriers are still the same. And that's... that you still have that sense of belonging, you know? So then again, you know, the upper tiers are different, they are new, and that also holds true for, you know, as an image, as a metaphor, because everything... That's happened to the club, of course. It's it's still one of the greatest ironies, I think, of in German football, that the one club that whether rightfully or not, you know, is perceived as being still authentic and and fan friendly and fan driven, is also one of only two clubs that have gone public. You know, you can buy Dortmund shares on the stock market. And it was the only club for a very long time. It's just recently that another small club has done the same. So that, of course, has been a massive change.
And if we go back to 2013, when there was the All-German Champions League final, I saw you in London when you were over for the final. It's something you talk about quite evocatively in the book, about it being some sort of turning point for Dortmund, because I've said this before for me. I said it to Carsten Kramer when I was speaking to him a while back about London is a city a bit like, I suppose, Paris, where or Berlin actually, where you can, it's a city of such size, such variety. You could go about, I mean, even in London, which has got 10 professional clubs, you can go about your daily life and you could quite easily not realise football existed or ignore football or whatever. But in that week leading up to the final, not between two English clubs, not between one English club and another club, but between two German clubs, London really was gripped by the occasion. And you talk in the book about how Londoners responded to Dortmund. How much of a turning point is this for the club's image?
I don't even remember if I wrote about that in building the yellow wall. I think I used it for Tor, because we were staying with a friend of mine near East Finchley Tube Station. And after the game, we went to a pub, which was a bald-headed stag or whatever.
Yeah.
And we sat down in the pub, and by that time, we no longer had club colours on. So we sat down in the pub and talked to her. I think there were some Manchester United fans there. Yeah. We were talking about the game. And suddenly, a cheer went up, and people started applauding, and we turned around, and some other guests had, you know, they stood up to leave, and they had Dortmund scarves on. And the pub staff, they lined up, you know,
behind the guard of honor.
Yeah, and we're applauding. Wow. So that was, you know, you're like, as a German, you're not used to that that sort of thing abroad, especially not as a football fan. So I think it was even before that Champions League final, because. One of the stories that I draw upon in the magazine in the book was that a couple of months before, 442 assigned me to do a cover story on Dortmund, and they said it was the first time that a German team was on the cover of 442 magazine,
even before Bayern.
Yeah, wow. And they said they had a choice, of course, between Dortmund and Bayern, because Bayern were also doing quite well at that time, and they felt that Dortmund was just a lot more sexy or attractive, or I don't know.
How did that make you feel? Was that surprising or natural? Or
well, it makes you think about the team again, if you know what I mean. Because
you're seeing it through new eyes, for an outsider's perspective.
Thinking, okay, now I've got to talk to all these players and the manager, and then I have to do write about my club. But for people who don't know as much about it as I do, or other Germans do, so I have to explain certain things, and also, so that makes you just think about why do they want me to write that, and who are these people? What is it that makes Klopp so unique, and things like that. So I think that was the first time. Well, obviously, I mean, they assigned me, you know, they assigned the story already because they felt there was this buzz around Dortmund.
Yes.
And that people, I mean, it's always been, in a way, it's always been like, well, not always, but funnily enough, there's now this thing about, you know, Brits coming over to Dortmund.
Yes.
To watch the club, you know, instead of their own club, or instead of a Premier League club or whatever. But we English soldiers were stationed in Dortmund, you know.
So that's not unusual.
British soldiers, I should say.
Yeah.
So as a kid, I was used to people suddenly, you know, yelling Sheffield United or whatever during a lull in the game, you know.
Yeah.
Because there were, you know, some soldiers scattered around the ground, and quite a few of them stayed, you know. There's a famous group of Scottish Dortmund supporters, you know, who go to the game wearing their kilts. And, you know, they were stationed in Dortmund, and they just, you know, they married a German girl and they stayed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
So how do people, not just in Germany, but particularly in Dortmund and Nordrhein-Westfalia, how do they view Jurgen Klopp's success at Liverpool?
There is a bit of a, you know, we've done a few pieces about the situation in Dortmund now for the magazine, which is, it's been a roller coaster season for Dortmund.
Sure.
You know, they've done fantastically well on some occasions, you know, conceded ridiculous goals, you know, threw away leads, you just cannot throw away, you know, conceding three goals at home against Paderborn, things like that. And there's been some criticism of the manager, you know, he was Lucien Favre, you know, and there was a time during the first half of the season where people thought he would be sacked. So we did pieces about that, and one of these things is always that, and the club themselves admit that and acknowledge that, is that, you know, he's so different from Klopp, you know.
As was Tuchel.
Yeah, he is a person, is so different. His football is different. And so people are always comparing any Dortmund coach anyway to Klopp all the time now. Mm. You know, he's not, you know, his football is not as attacking, or he's not as smart, or he's not as emotional, or whatever. Mm. But of course, right now, we also have the problem that Klopp is doing, you know, is having the season of his life.
Yes.
You know, I mean, until he lost that game, you know, that recent game, there was a decent chance they would go unbeaten this season, you know, and he just won the Champions League. So, which is, you know, so the shadow this season is becoming, you know, normally...
Even longer.
Yeah, normally, you know, with time passes and the shadow becomes smaller. But with Klopp, it's becoming bigger all the time, which is really a problem for the club. In a way, and there's this cliche, and there is, I admit it, there is some truth to it. There's this cliche about the Dortmund fan who watches Dortmund play on the telly and then switches over to see how Liverpool are doing, and then spends more and more time watching the Liverpool game. And it's really,
you know, TV subscriptions are very expensive these days. You've got to make the most of everything you've got on your TV.
It's really, I wrote this for the magazine because over Christmas, I went back to Dortmund, and we have a few, my son's girlfriend has a very large family, so Christmas now, you know, consists of three or four parties, family parties, and at one point, somebody would always say, when's Klopp playing? You know, is it tomorrow, today? Who are they playing? And... It's funny, yeah. Or maybe it's not funny. I think it's funny. But
no, it's funny. It's definitely funny. So, one of your other books. I mean, you've written what, nine? Does that sound about right?
I don't know.
After the first three,
I'm not trying to be. What's the word? Coquettish.
Yeah. But, well, one of them anyway is on Mesut Özil.
Yeah, I was just one author.
Yeah.
I mean. It's a book about Özil, and there's a couple of writers who were asked to cover certain aspects of his career.
But he is a fascinating figure, and he's become a sort of a bit of a withdrawn figure
in
English football. But obviously far more serious than him not being able to get in the team at Arsenal or not being that important at Arsenal is what happened to him post 2018 World Cup. How do you see that now?
Yeah, probably in retrospect, we will one day we'll say it was one of the strangest football careers we've ever seen.
Yes.
You know, because he's always divided his opinion. Mm. As a player, I mean. You know,
Is that because of his manner?
Yeah, no, I think of his playing style. He's, yeah. I think he's very much a manager's player, because all the managers he's played under have rated him very highly, and he's played under very good managers. You know,
and very different managers.
And very different managers, and but he's just the sort of player, you know. Fans will get angry about it if things are not getting right, you know. He's not a grafter, you know. He's not a guy who gets stuck in, and he's just sort of, I don't know. I mean, we had in a way, he's the classical 70s midfield genius,
yes.
You know. He does a lot of... I mean, the funny thing is that if you look at his stats, they're all great. People always say he's not running, but you look at the stats, and he does cover a lot of ground.
That's proved not to be the case.
People say, oh, he's not doing anything, you know, he's just passing the ball around, and you look at the stats, and he's setting up all the goals, you know, the pass before the final pass, or something like that. It's just that, I don't know, it's just his body language or the way he plays the game is... I think you have to be a real football connoisseur to really appreciate that. Anyway, he's always divided opinion that way as a player. And then we don't have to go to all the background. You know, you know the background to the...
Yeah, exactly.
But it was really... when that photo came out at the magazine, we immediately knew this is going to be trouble.
Well, it's funny because we were going around. You and I were going around the National Football Museum in Dortmund.
The photos there.
And they've got the Hall of Fame there, and they've got the names of every player to have ever played for the senior German national team. And our guide was telling us that his name has been scratched off the wall like four times. So obviously, people still have a massive bee in their bonnet about it.
It's also because I think because I mean, it's not Gundogan and Özil were both on the photo, the German FA badly mishandled that number one, because we at the magazine, maybe it's because we're media people, but they've got their own media people. We immediately knew, you know, just a couple of days away from a World Cup, this is, you know, news. This will make the news no matter what, you know. Everything having to do with football in the World Cup is making the news now. Now with all this social media stuff we have, you know, everybody's going to have an opinion about that.
Yes.
Now with this media climate, you know, where people are totally get worked up about everything.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. And finally, and sadly, but it's true, there are still racial prejudices towards Turkish players. You have to say that, you know. So these people will have a field day, you know. You just knew that. People say, obviously, Turkey is more important to him than Germany, so he's playing for Germany, and so on and so on. So in the German FA, as I said, they underestimated that very, very badly. So and from that, it just snowballed. But as I just said, he's always divided opinion. Mm. So from his playing style, from the fact that he very rarely gives interviews. Mm. So he was the perfect target for that.
Well, that's the thing. When a player doesn't give interviews, especially today, just speculation rises to fill the vacuum about what they're like and how they conduct themselves. And especially with any sort of famous people, we love to profess that we know them. Yeah. Because they're part of our daily lives. We see them on screen and we read about them all the time. When actually we know nothing about them, really, as people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And he handled the situation totally different from Gundogan, who was also in the photo, who gave interviews, who explained the situation. and Uzi just did nothing, basically did nothing. And then he issued a public statement via, was it Facebook or Twitter or both, I forget, which was clearly very much, which was, you know, worded and drafted by an agent or a press agent or whatever. It was very unfortunate. But as far as I'm concerned, there is a disturbing racist undertone to all that. And which was for a long time. I mean, one of the things that I write about in Tor is that I have Dutch friends.
Yeah.
And for a very long time, they kept asking me, why is the German team so, you know, so white?
Yes.
So not multicultural.
Yeah.
You know, in pretty much in contrast to the Dutch team. And they even took a sense of pride, you know, in the fact that they had all these black players and the German team looked like, I don't know, like it was the 50s or something.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, with our history, we didn't have the colonies, you know, we didn't have the migration. Mm. And after two wars, it took a lot of time until people felt that, hey, we should move to Germany, it's a cool place to live. So it took us a long time, well, longer than other countries. But gradually, I mean, I always say that I coached youth teams in the late 90s. And when I did that, it was clear that it was only a matter of time until this would be reflected, because I coached, I don't know, kids with Ghanese parents or Albanian parents or whatever. And and this finally, I think, at around the turn of the century, the German national team became a lot more multicultural to reflect what the society is like now in a modern country. But we never really had a discussion about that. I mean, we shouldn't have a discussion. There's still people who tell me that Özil, you know, is one of those Turkish players, and I would say, well, he's not Turkish, you know, he's German. He's from Gelsenkirchen. But, you know, a lot of people still feel like that. Anyway, but we didn't have that discussion as a society, maybe because we as Germans felt we couldn't or shouldn't have that. Other countries had that, you know. I mean, there was this debate in Switzerland, you know, about all they had a lot of players from...
The under-17 side.
But we never conference. Had that. It was like a subject you wouldn't touch. You wouldn't never mention, you know. And this other thing just proved that it was still, you know, it's still under the surface. That there are we do have a minority of racist fans who feel that, I don't know, a German team should be, I don't know, whatever. I don't know what even the name, what even the term
is. What they considered.
German. I don't even know what it is in the 21st century.
No, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, but so that was another aspect that played into this whole thing, which is why Özil has become almost persona non grata now.
Yeah, it's sad. Well, you've been super generous with your time, and I know I'm keeping you from dessert or coffee or similar. So just one final question. Tell us about the next book.
You're from England, right?
I am.
You've got a great literature. You've got a great football literature. What I always liked about England was that there would be one English writer who would write a book about a great person, a great, fantastic player, no matter where he's from or who he is. I mean, you've got books about Pushkas or whatever, right? Or Cruyff. And it occurred to my agent that there's no proper biography of Franz Beckenbauer, you know, one of the greatest players ever. And
a complex character as well.
And a very complex story.
When we were in the football museum yesterday, they were having the discussion about that. They have this, for people who haven't been there, they have this big number 5, which is about... I guess about 2.5-3 meters tall, and it's got inside it all items of Beckenbauer history, like shirts and awards and all that sort of stuff. There's an ARD Sports Personality of the Year in there somewhere, isn't there? All that sort of stuff, and yet he's going through some things at the moment.
Yeah, he's going to be. Well, he's, you know, the 2006 World Cup is vastly important, you know, in all kinds of ways for this country.
In terms of the game's self-image.
Yeah, and also the game's self-image and also the country's self-image. Mm. Because for us as Germans, it's felt that until that point, a lot of people still had reservations about Germany, right. You know. And then they came and found the country to be different from what they thought it would be. Mm. And, I mean, that was the gist of a lot of post-World Cup coverage, that, yes, we went out in the semis, but it was not really about football. It was about, you know, showing people that this is now a modern, open country, and it's not what you think it is. So, and now it turns out that maybe, you know, we bribed our way into getting this World Cup. We wouldn't be the first or the last.
No, exactly.
Not the point. So that's a big discussion in Germany now, a big debate, and the court case is coming up. So Beckenbauer's reputation is tarnished at the moment.
So you can write the first 17 chapters, but not the 18th.
No, so that's what they were talking about in the museum. You know,
yes.
That's what they said. But the interesting thing about Beckenbauer is, and that sort of was part of my expose, as this would be a third life, because in his first life he was the greatest player we had. Maybe the greatest player we'll ever have, but people didn't really like him. He was a Bayern Munich player. He was a bit arrogant. I'm not going to tell you the book, you know.
You still have to buy it.
he left Germany in 1977. Not least due to tax problems, you know, having problems with the tax authorities, and went to America. And when he left, he was really, a lot of people would say, he's a great player, but I just don't like him, you know. He's not Fritz Walter, yeah. You know. Then he sort of reinvented himself in America. And he came back, and then he became national manager and so on. And then he became the guy who not only won the World Cup as a player and as a manager, but also won the World Cup as a, you know, by getting us the World Cup as a, because that was, you know, that was the public perception that, there is some truth to this, I think, that he was constantly touring the globe, you know, promoting the German bid. So at that point, he was suddenly a totally different Beckenbauer, you know, after all those achievements, it was, people really loved him, you know. Not just for his achievements, but also the kind of person he had become, his irreverent jokes and his self-deprecating humor and all this. So that was his second life, and now, sadly, he's probably going to have a third life, you know, where people at the German Football Museum are seriously discussing, you know, taking down those things, which is...
It's really sad.
It's sad and it's ridiculous. I mean, those things are there for his achievements as a player, you know. But yeah, it's a fascinating life, fascinating person, and so yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
Well, I can't wait for the book.
No, thank you.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.